From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, How We Die, we talk with surgeon and teacher Sherwin Newland. Newland says the classic deathbed scene is a myth, that we expect too much from a dying person's last moments. Dr. Newland has written a new book about the clinical and biological realities of death. Also today, tight pants, tight sweaters, and high-heeled shoes. We talk with Anne Margaret. A sex symbol in the 60s, she's now starring opposite two grumpy old men. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new recording by the country music band The Mavericks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. NATO officials say they're firm behind their demand that Bosnian Serbs pull their artillery from the hills above Sarajevo or face airstrikes. But the United Nations forces in Bosnia have worked out a compromise with the fighters. This would allow the Serbs to regroup their heavy weapons at bases under UN monitors, but the UN would not control the weapons. NATO officials say that's not good enough. They now say they're trying to head off a fight with a world body over the matter. The UN peacekeeping commander says no matter what NATO says, airstrikes will be made only on his orders. A Serb who is wanted for war crimes in Bosnia has been arrested and charged in Germany. NPR's Dieter Berger reports.
The federal prosecutor's office says 28-year-old Dusko Tadic is charged as an accessory to genocide. German law allows the prosecution of war crimes that violate international law. The Serb was arrested at his apartment in Munich over the weekend, where he evidently had been hiding for the past several months, on a tip from a German television team. In a statement, the prosecutor's office said Tadic is fanatically committed to a greater Serbia and to ethnic cleansing. He is charged with the knifing and shooting of inmates at the Omarska concentration camp in June of 1992. Tadic was identified by former prisoners in an Austrian government report on war atrocities to the United Nations. Human rights groups in Germany estimate 1,500 Muslims and Croats were murdered in the camp at Omarska. I'm Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
The White House confirms it's thinking about possible trade sanctions against Japan. A spokeswoman says Trade Representative Mickey Cantor is ready to announce new high tariffs on Japanese-made cellular phones as early as tomorrow. Three manufacturers of silicone breast implants have agreed to a tentative settlement of a multi-million-dollar class action suit filed against them. Vicky Quay of member station WHYY reports.
Lawyers for Dow Corning, Bristol Myers Squibb, and Baxter International have announced a deal to fund a $4.75 billion liability plan that was worked out with federal mediators in Philadelphia. Under the agreement, Dow Corning's Gary Anderson says the company will pay up to $2 billion to resolve claims from women that come in over the next 30 years.
A trust fund would be created where the money would go, and then that would be overseen by the court through some form of similar to an insurance company managing a health fund.
Anderson says women who file claims will be able to keep the matter private. Bristol Myers will pay $1.5 billion. Women who have received silicone implants have claimed they've suffered immune system disorders and other problems from ruptured implants. I'm Vicky Quay.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 7 points at 3,901. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Israel and the PLO are trying to settle their remaining differences on Palestinian self-rule. They're working on security and administrative matters. The differences are holding up a final agreement on Palestinian autonomy. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres said there are still a lot of outstanding issues that Israel and the Palestinians need to resolve. The talks in Taba resumed today after last week's agreement between Israel and the PLO in Cairo on several previous sticking points, such as control of border crossings and security for Jewish settlers in Gaza. Palestinian delegation head Nabil Shaaf said that most of the difficult issues have already been resolved. Shaaf also rejected Palestinian criticism that the PLO had given up too much during last week's talks in Cairo. He said the PLO had gotten the best it could under the circumstances and that PLO leader Yasser Arafat did not want the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza and Jericho delayed any further. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A new study finds the Clinton administration's health care plan spells good news for states. The Urban Institute says the Clinton plan would save some states about $8 billion. That's because the federal government would pay a greater part of the care for the poor. But the Urban Institute warns that some states might not save enough, like those who get extra federal Medicaid funding from provider taxes and donations. But overall, states that give at least $61 billion to Medicaid will see their contribution drop to $53 billion. Warmer temperatures should begin melting ice and snow today that have piled up across the eastern part of the United States. Days of freezing rain, sleet, and snow plagued the East Coast last week. More than 250,000 people in Tennessee are without power. Schools are closed in several counties because of poor driving conditions. The warmer weather is causing problems in Kentucky. Several hundred people have been evacuated because of flooding. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Because my guest is a doctor, he has witnessed many deaths. In the new book, How We Die, Dr. Sherwin Nuland writes that nowadays, very few of us actually witness the deaths of those we love. So an entire mythology has grown up around the process of dying. In his new book, he has attempted to present death in its biological and clinical reality. He says only by a frank discussion of the very details of dying can we best deal with those aspects that frighten us the most. Dr. Nuland teaches surgery and the history of medicine at Yale. We all hope to die a good death, but Dr. Nuland writes the good death is a myth, and part of that myth is the idea of death with dignity.
We have this idea, which is propagated by books, by articles that we see in journals and in newspapers, that death somehow is a noble series of events that culminates in the great deathbed scene of the dying person, or perhaps the patriarchal person surrounded by loved ones, and he or she is imparting final wisdom, and there are no strands left untied. That almost never happens, and when it does happen, it's an absolute coincidence and has very little to do with the life of the person that occurred before that final period of life.
You feel you've rarely seen death with dignity?
One of the points I try to make in this book, and I make it a number of times in a number of different ways, is that what gives dignity to death is the dignity of the life that preceded it. When we have brought about a situation where we are loved and we love, where our lives have been lives not necessarily of great accomplishment, but of a sense of having given something to others, whether those others are as close to us as our children or parents, or whether those others are as far away as a radio or television audience, when we have done that, our deaths have dignity. Our deaths become a part of our lives in the sense that with our deaths, we give something to those who are left behind, as we have given our lives to them.
In your book, you write about something very personal that happened to you, and that was your brother had colon cancer. Colon cancer had killed your mother when you were 11. So when your brother got colon cancer, he asked you to be his doctor and to, you know, help him decide what he should do. And you say in your book that you had discovered how much the cancer had spread and how far gone his condition was, but you didn't want to tell him the extent to which the cancer was spreading. You were afraid of telling your brother the truth. You were afraid it would take away his hope. Why did you make that decision to not tell him the truth?
Well, first, I have to point out that I wasn't his doctor. Actually, I've always followed a philosophy of choosing the best doctors I can for people in my family who become sick and then just agreeing with what they think is appropriate if it seems reasonable. And that's what I did in my brother's situation. He was in another city. He was here in New York City. And, of course, I was in New Haven. And I watched this process unfold. What actually happened was that he was operated upon, and the finding was a very far advanced malignancy, which from every bit of clinical knowledge I had, and this is a disease that I treat every day of my life in New Haven, every bit of clinical knowledge I had could not possibly be cured. I told my brother he had cancer. I told my brother there was cancer in his liver. I did not want to beat him over the head by telling him there was fluid in his abdomen and there were cancer cells in the fluid and there were dots of cancer on virtually every intraperitoneal, intra-abdominal organ. I didn't see at that point the sense in that, but the mistake that I made by not telling him everything was to make him think that there was a possibility that something could be done. What was even worse was that when I looked at him, my boyhood friend, you know, we had gone through so much together through all these years, when I looked at him, I saw in his eyes myself reflected, the smart kid brother who'd gone off to Yale and become a doctor, and I should be able to save him. So I began looking around, is there something new? Is there something new? And my God, there was an experimental therapy that I knew perfectly well stood only a small chance of getting him through. But foolishly, at that time, I thought of hope as being the hope of cure, the hope of rescue. And I followed the philosophy that anything is better than death. So what I did was to put him through, this was at my suggestion, my recommendation, a series of chemotherapy treatments that stood only a very small chance of curing him. And what I succeeded in doing was to take away an opportunity for some months of being with his family at peace, slowly dying of this disease. And what I exchanged for it was a death that was terribly, terribly difficult. And I have not forgiven myself for it. I should not forgive myself for it. And I write about it in the book because I wanted people to know that with the very, very, very best of intentions, what we sometimes think of as something very good for those we love turns out to be very bad for those we love, because had I been a detached clinical physician in New Haven and such a patient had presented himself to me, I would have said, don't do this chemotherapy protocol. It's senseless. You stand only a small chance of cure. We shouldn't do it. But this was my brother. And so I lost all my objectivity, and I tried it.
But let me ask you, had you not tried it, after your brother died, might you have been wondering, say, we tried that therapy. Sure, there was only a small percentage it would have helped him, but it might have. Maybe I should have given it a shot.
That's one of the reasons I tried it.
Uh-huh.
I didn't want to have to later on say I should have given it a shot. But that's exactly what I mean when I say it's with the best of intentions that we carry out these exercises in futility. We want to do the right thing. But what we should do is step back and let more objective people make such decisions.
I recently read an article in the New York Times that talked about how difficult it is now for patients to make decisions about what course of therapy to take or whether to not take any at all because it's hopeless. And, you know, doctors have given us the chance to participate in the decisions. On the other hand, to participate intelligently, you nearly have to become a doctor yourself sometimes. Is this a dilemma for you as a doctor, how much a patient needs to know in order to kind of participate in an educated way in one of these big decisions?
Well, I think that's a major problem. We were taught in my day in medical school, and certainly that continued into the 60s, 70s, and 80s, to be what's called a paternalistic physician. Only we can understand the proper course of therapy in any disease. I tell the story in the book of a 92-year-old woman who had a perforated ulcer of a duodenum, and she came in with peritonitis, and she wanted to die. She had no relatives. She really felt she had nothing to look forward to. And I said, Miss Welsh, you know, there's a 1 in 3 chance, and you have to be crazy not to take a 1 in 3 chance. I talked her into it. She survived the operation, but she had a stroke a few weeks later when she was back at the convalescent hospital, and she died. And I realized, looking back on the whole situation, that I had taken my value system and enforced it on her. In my value system, as a high-tech surgeon in a university teaching hospital, a 1 in 3 chance was certainly appropriate to take. Anything is better than death. Well, you know, that's not true. It's not so that anything is better than death. As a wise oncology nurse said to me, there are many people, more than you would dream, and many of our listeners, I think, probably fall into this category, for whom what you have to go through in order to come out on the other side alive is simply not worth the effort. I've seen so many patients, particularly elderly patients over the years, who become debilitated and changed by the process by which I cure them or another doctor cures them. And has it really been worth it?
Let's get back to this patient who is in her 90s, Hazel Welch. And she, you thought there was a 1 in 3 chance that surgery would save her life. She really didn't want to go through with it, but you talked her into it. What would you have done today?
Well, here comes the great moral dilemma. I say in the book very clearly, if I had thought more objectively and intelligently about this, I would have said, Ms. Welch, you're right. I've looked on the face sheet of your chart, and your closest of kin is a trust officer at the bank, the man who takes care of your money. There is nobody in this world whose life would be affected right now by your death. This woman had leukemia. She was in remission from leukemia. She had severe gangrenous changes in her toe. She was about to lose her toe. She really didn't have a lot to look forward to. So I say in the book, well, you know, if I knew then and thought then the way I know now and think now, I would have let her die as she wished. And then I start the next paragraph, and I'll remind you of it by saying, no, that's a lie. What I've written is a lie. Suppose I had let her die. Well, on Thursday afternoon at 5 o'clock at the Yale New Haven Hospital, there's a conference called Mortality and Morbidity. I would have had to explain to my colleagues what I had done, and they would look at me as if I were nuts, or worse than nuts, if I were dangerous, and say, what right did you have to let a 92-year-old woman make a decision like that? You've been a surgeon for 30 years, and you let some old lady living in a convalescent hospital decide whether she should die of peritonitis? That's not her decision. That's a clinical decision, they would say. That's not an ethical decision. Leave morals and morality and ethics to the ethicists and the ministers and the who knows what's. Your job as a physician is to do the best thing you can to save her life. Now, we have to respect that point of view, but I just want listeners and patients to know that that isn't their point of view, that doctors have an agenda which is very often quite different than the agenda of the patients they're treating. And I'm deliberately talking about the very best doctors, and we all like to think that our doctors are the very best, and in the United States we have a remarkably high percentage of very finely trained doctors, very highly motivated doctors. A doctor is in the business of curing disease. He is not what I call a pastor. He's a clinical physician. When I reach the end of my life, there are going to be a lot of things that go into my deciding whether I want to continue or not. And this is true for you, Terry. This is true for every listener. It is not a clinical decision. It's a personal, a moral, a social, a religious, a spiritual decision. The doctor can help me with part of that, but he can't help me with all of it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Sherwin Nuland, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, How We Die. We're going to take a short break, and then Dr. Nuland will talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Sherwin Nuland, author of How We Die. We've all heard reports of near-death experiences where instead of enduring agony right at the end, people who've nearly died and come back and tell us about it, tell us about this feeling of tranquility, of a glowing light that they saw, of a sense of being at peace. Do you have patients who've told you about that after they nearly died?
Yes, I have, and I have had a recent patient who 2 months ago told me about being rushed to the operating room with a dreadful peritonitis, and I had operated on her, and I didn't find out until much later that she had a vision of her father, who had died 10 years before, telling her that she would survive. I think these kinds of things happen. I think they are real. I don't think anybody invents them. But I think I have an explanation for them. As I and other doctors have tried to make some analogy between these experiences and things that we actually see in clinical practice, there is an analogy. And the analogy is that some patients, when given morphine-like compounds, not only have a sense of relief of pain, but they have a sense of tranquility, and some patients will even have visions. And I think that what happens in these near-death experiences is that compounds called endorphins, which are morphine-like compounds produced inside of one, that's where the name comes from, end meaning inside, orphan, morphine-like endorphins, are produced in large amounts. And that's been tested. Trauma victims who've had such severe bleeding that they bled into shock can be demonstrated to have high levels of endorphins. I think this happens with many trauma patients. I think it happens with coronary patients. And I attribute these kinds of visions to the large increase in endorphins that can easily be demonstrated in the laboratory.
Can you predict from the type of disease one has or a certain kind of accident one could experience whether the last sensation before death would be one of agony or one of, you know, this kind of bathed in a warm presence?
I don't think so. The bathed in the warm presence, of course, is much more frequently described in situations of injury, sudden death.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's coronary artery disease, but more likely it's an injury, most specifically an injury that has to do with considerable blood loss.
Like a car accident.
Like a car accident, yes, or like the stabbing that I describe in the book of the little girl who was killed by a homicidal maniac who died with this expression on her face that indicated to her mother and to me, as I was told about it, that she did not die in pain or terror.
So you think that the endorphins might be more likely to be released in trauma than at the end of a cancer death?
Yes, and I think it has evolutionary value for our species, Terry. I think that what this represents is, of course, that in prehistoric times, trauma was a very common cause of death, whether people fighting each other or the old saber-toothed tiger invading the village. People who panic in the presence of trauma are much more likely to die. So people capable of making a lot of endorphins and remaining somewhat tranquil are more likely to live to reproduce. So over the course of millions of years, we have developed a species very likely to put out large amounts of endorphins when something suddenly traumatic happens.
You're a doctor. You have witnessed many other people's deaths, including, you know, deaths of people very close to you. And you know about how a dying person can lose control in a hospital, for instance. Are you kind of preparing documents now so that if, like, you know, some point in the future you find yourself with a chronic illness or something in a hospital, the doctor proceeds in such a way that would follow your wishes?
You know that there's now a federal law requiring that every patient entering a hospital have the opportunity to provide such documents so that there will be no question, should a patient become comatose or unable to make a conscious decision, there will be no question about what that patient wants done at the end of life. And if I can urge our listeners to do anything, it's to take those directives very, very seriously. Look over the papers you are given if you go into a hospital and make a decision about what you want done.
So are you preparing any documents now? Or
I myself.
Yeah.
I have not prepared any documents, but I have told my four children, I have told my wife exactly what I want done under which circumstances, because to my mind, of course I will prepare a document if I'm admitted to a hospital, but to my mind, the most important thing is not the legality of the document, but the knowledge for those who are left behind that whatever the decision they make to end my life is the right decision and they don't have to live with any sense of guilt about it.
Well, that's interesting. So the main thing you're trying to tell them is that you kind of trust them and that they don't have to be racked with agony about whether they made the right choice or not.
The main thing I'm trying to tell them by everything I do every day is what sort of person I am. And the sort of person I am, and I suspect this is true of the great majority of your listeners, is a person who would not want extreme measures to be taken when a wise physician thinks that it's futile to do it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that concerns you about hospitals, you point out statistically that many more people die in hospitals now than ever before, and you think that that often robs the dying people and the people who love them from any kind of like final deathbed experience together. It often doesn't always. Often people are at the hospital at that time, but often they're not. Have you ever been at the deathbed of a loved one when they were? And they were going?
I have never personally been at the bedside of someone I loved when they died. That's not what counts, because much of the time, I would say perhaps most of the time, the person who is dying during the last hours or perhaps even the last day is not completely aware of what's happening. What's important is to live through the process of dying with this person. People overemphasize the last hour or the last minute. What counts is the process that's leading toward death. That's when people need to have the concordance with loved ones that's so important. The help, the support, it's during the pain and the mess and the misery that most of us will die in that we need those we love. There is no tying together of strings at the last hour. That's a very rare phenomenon. It's the thing of romance. It's the thing of movies and television. It's not the thing of real life. The thing of real life and the time a dying person needs the family and the loved ones the most is during that awful time when he or she is going through the weeks preceding those final hours.
One more thing. You talk about how doctors have always been taught to give their patients hope, even if the patient is dying. But you write about the need to redefine hope. How do you define hope now, the kind of hope you want to give a dying patient?
Well, let me define hope in a meaningful way, at least a way that's meaningful to me. You know, if we were going to use a dictionary definition of hope and look them all up, we would find out that the one thing that brings them all together is the belief that some good thing may yet happen. The good thing that may yet happen during dying is not the possibility of survival when we're beyond that point. The good thing that may yet happen is that our lives will have great meaning for those we leave behind. To me, the hope that can exist at the time of death is the hope of our heritage, that we have really meant something to people, whether they are our own children or friends or students, whatever, or people who listen to us on the radio. That's the hope. The hope that your heritage is something good for others. And I think when you think of death as being part of the life cycle and recognize that death is an inevitability for our species because the world has to be renewed with each death, then the hope becomes, when it is renewed, it will be renewed by people on whom I have had some influence for good.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherwin Nuland is the author of How We Die. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, how a good girl who loved her parents and the Lord became a sex symbol. We talk with Anne Margaret about her life, her career, and her relationship with Elvis. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews What a Crying Shame, the new release by the country music band The Mavericks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. NATO and the United Nations are disagreeing about NATO's ultimatum to the Bosnian Serbs. NATO says the Serbs have until Monday to move their heavy weapons from around Sarajevo or face airstrikes. But the UN says the deadline only means that airstrikes will become an option. The BBC's Kathy Jenkins reports from Sarajevo.
The ultimatum issued by NATO seems straightforward. It said to the Bosnian Serbs, put your weapons under UN control or face airstrikes. But over the past days, clarity has disappeared under a mountain of questions. What exactly does control of weapons mean? Should there be airstrikes if the ceasefire is holding and a reasonable percentage of the weapons are under UN control? Crucially, who will order the airstrikes? The Americans are taking a hard line. They say the NATO ultimatum must be fully complied with or the Serbs will be bombed. On the ground, however, the UN negotiators are injecting a note of flexibility. They suggest that the deadline of Sunday midnight is simply the moment at which airstrikes become an option if the ultimatum has not been fulfilled.
Kathy Jenkins reporting. President Clinton is debating whether to use trade sanctions against Japan in retaliation for its $50 billion trade surplus. Trade talks between the United States and Japan collapsed last week. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
The president is still not saying what specific options his administration is considering in wake of the failed trade talks with Japan, but hints an announcement on sanctions could come as early as tomorrow in response to Japan's refusal to open its cellular telephone market to Motorola.
It is simply no longer acceptable for their own consumers as well as for the rest of us, for them to follow a policy so radically different from the policy of every other advanced economy.
While signing the annual economic report, President Clinton acknowledged that slapping penalty duties on certain Japanese imports could lead to a trade war, but insists it's unacceptable for the U.S. to continue on the same path with Japan. Carol Van Dam, The White House.
The Commerce Department says stocks of unsold goods were the same in December as they were in November. The government says business inventories were unchanged, but business sales grew 8%. A buildup of inventory can be dangerous for the economy. If stocks pile up too fast, factories can cut production and workers can be laid off. A published report says figure skater Nancy Kerrigan has signed a $1 million TV deal with a Walt Disney Company, ABC, and a Hollywood producer. Newsweek magazine says the deal includes a TV skating special, a book, and appearances at Disney theme parks. There will also be a TV movie about Kerrigan's assault last month at the U.S. Figure Skating Championships. Newsweek also says a Nancy Kerrigan doll may also be in the works. Stock prices were mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow rose 9 points to end at 3904. This is NPR. Warmer temperatures across the East Coast are helping today to melt the snow and ice, but the runoff has caused flooding in some parts of Kentucky. Authorities in the south are tallying damage caused by last week's ice storm. Kevin Farrell of Public Radio in Mississippi has this report.
In Tennessee, more than 250,000 people still had no electricity yesterday. Authorities with the Tennessee Emergency Management Agency estimated that about 500,000 residents have had power restored, but there are still 128,000 homes with no lights. The city of Lynchburg, Virginia, remained under an overnight curfew for the third day yesterday, as the city has no working streetlights and businesses have no alarm systems. The hardest hit area in Mississippi is the Mississippi Delta, where Mississippi Power and Light Company lost more than 640 transmission towers and at least 6,000 distribution poles. Authorities say that some of the hardest hit areas could be without power for several weeks. However, a warming trend forecast for the southeast could help speed the recovery process. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Farrell in Jackson, Mississippi.
Iran has reaffirmed its death sentence for British author Salman Rushdie. The Ayatollah Khomeini ordered Rushdie's death sentence 5 years ago for his work, The Satanic Verses. The Iranian government maintains his work is a blasphemy against Islam. The Iranian news service says the death sentence must be carried out, even though Rushdie has tried to reconcile with the Islamic community. Israeli and PLO negotiators are discussing the size of a Palestinian police force. Both sides are meeting in Taba, Egypt. The PLO wants a force of 20,000 in the region to be governed by Palestinians. The Israelis want a smaller force of about 6,000. The PLO is demanding the release of Palestinians in jail. The PLO says 14,000 Palestinians are imprisoned. Israel says only half that many are detained. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The co-star of Grumpy Old Men used to be a sex kitten. Anne Margaret got her start in films like State Fair, in which she gave Eddie Fisher his first film kiss, Bye Bye Birdie, in which she got one last kiss from a swivel-hipped rock and roller, and Viva Las Vegas, in which she got her kiss from Elvis himself. Anne Margaret has written an autobiography about her life on and off camera. Her career was launched by George Burns, who put her in his Christmas act in Vegas in 1960. She wanted to wear a great outfit when she performed with him, so she went shopping and picked up what she thought was the perfect thing, an orange-red velvet pantsuit.
Oh, please. I had never been in this real chic boutique, ever. I was too scared to, and of course I knew that the prices were way beyond what I had. So I gathered all the money I had together because I wanted to get this real spiffy outfit. And it was bright orange-red velvet pantsuit. And I thought, well, this is terrific. So on opening night day at the dress rehearsal, I wore this. And I just was so excited. I couldn't wait to show Mr. Burns. I said, and then he saw me. And he came over and he said, what's that? I said, well, oh, this is what I'm going to wear tonight. Isn't it terrific? Is this beautiful? Look at the velvet and everything. He says, what happened to the sweater and pants that you wore for the audition? The tight sweater and the tight pants. And I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, Annie, people don't only want to hear your voice. They want to see where it's coming from. And I never, ever forgot about that. Not to this day, I haven't forgotten about it.
So you took off the velvet pantsuit and put on tight pants and a tight sweater and heels?
Yes, but then something weird happened. Again, two or three nights later, the waitresses who, they were so dear to me. I'm 18 years old at the time. They were very protective of me. And they thought that that was the wrong image of me. So they went to Gracie Allen, and they said, please tell Mr. Burns, you know, we don't think that that outfit is right. So Gracie went to Mr. Burns, and he asked me, do you have a dress? And, of course, the only dress that I had was the one that I had worn on that Jack Benny show, TV show, where Mr. Burns introduced me. This is like a couple of weeks before. I only had three outfits to my name. So, of course, I put that on, and everyone was happy.
But, I mean, finally, I think the tight pants and sweater image became something of your image, didn't it?
Yes, I did my 20th Century Fox screen test in that. You know, the first part was... an acting sequence for the part of the Jeannie Crane role in State Fair.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part is called the personality test. That's when I let my hair go, and I had black tights and a bright red top. And in fact, I still have that top. And when the president saw it, president of 20th Century Fox saw it, he decided that I should play the other part, the Vivian Blaine part, the woman from the other side of the tracks.
That you'd be not the good girl, but the rambunctious girl.
That was from the personality test where I did Bill Bailey, Won't You Please Come Home, and moved around and stuff. And so with that, they bleached my hair bright orange, and I became the bad girl.
Mm-hmm. Now let me take you back to Bye Bye Birdie. How did you get the part?
Well, Mr. George Sidney told me much later, he had seen me, I was with a date at the Sands Hotel, and it was on New Year's Eve, and we were, I was dancing with his friend because my date didn't want to, didn't know how to do the twist. So I was twisting with this terrific dancer. And Mr. Sidney saw me there and thought of me at that point for Bye Bye Birdie.
He thought you'd be the perfect teenager?
Yes. And I had this bright orange hair from, I had done State Fair. And this was what? Well, this was New Year's Eve. And in May, I was called in to read for the part, or just to meet Mr. Sidney. And I looked everywhere to find an appropriate outfit. Boy, it took me like a whole day to find a cardigan sweater, pleated, I only had one pleated skirt, rust-colored, low-heeled shoes. I only had one pair of those. I never wore them. And I went in very demure and sat there. And he had the hardest time, he told me later, not from laughing out loud, because he knew that was so like me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ann Margaret, and she's written a new memoir called Ann Margaret. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ann Margaret, who's written a new memoir. Now, it's funny because, you know, in Bye Bye Birdie, there's the character of Conrad Birdie, who is, you know, loosely based on Elvis Presley. And then right about the same time as Birdie, you ended up working with Elvis Presley on Viva Las Vegas.
Isn't that weird? It's just so uncanny. And I had never seen him perform, ever.
Did you knew his records, though?
I had heard his records, yes, but I'd never seen him move. And when I first met him at this rehearsal hall, you know, we were both very shy and very well-mannered, very polite. And then we started moving. I say this in the book. I mean, it was the weirdest thing. I look over at him, and he's moving with the same kind of, well, I'm not going to tell you what kind of movements that I was doing.
Some kind of swivel you're talking
about? Below the waist.
Uh-huh.
But we both felt it the same way. So it was quite a pleasant rehearsal.
Now, you started seeing each other while making Viva Las Vegas, right?
Yes.
So what was it like for you to have a relationship with somebody who, I mean, you were a celebrity, he was an icon by then, and people just fantasize and project onto people like you and he. So can a real-life relationship measure up to the fantasies that people have about what a relationship with a person like that would be?
Sure.
Sure.
We had a great time, absolutely great time. I will cherish those memories, that the 14 years of being friends with him all my life.
How long were you actually seeing each other?
Oh, let's see, probably a year, year and a half, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we did remain friends. And actually, Roger and he got along really great.
This is your husband, Roger
yes.
Smith. Let me get to your 1971 film, Carnal Knowledge, which you got many very good reviews. In this movie, you played somebody who, you know, was beautiful and sexy, but had become something of a victim to that because she was in such a demeaning relationship with a man.
The problem, and I know several women like this and several men like this. The problem with the Bobby Templetons of the world and whoever we will say is the counterpart, whatever man, they choose the wrong mate. They do not have any self-esteem. They sort of know, they really deep down inside know that this person is going to destroy them, but they just are, they're sick, they're ill. They keep going from man to man as the same man.
But you're in your book, it seems like you had a lot of troubles while you were making that picture.
Well, I became the person. I had nightmares about that one.
You were afraid something like that would happen to you?
No. I started, it was a terrible thing with the sleeping pills and the, you know, substance abuse.
Mm-hmm. Was it the first movie that you'd had that problem with?
I had trouble with abuse. I didn't do it during the movie. I did not do it on screen,
mm-hmm.
not during work. I had a problem with it for about 5 years, and I took care of it.
I want to quote something that you said back in 1971. This was in Look magazine. And you said that your husband, quote, has complete autonomy over me. After all, I enjoy being a girl, having someone to take care of me, being told where to go and what to do. Would you still say that about yourself?
No. That was within my five-year period.
What five-year period?
Yes, the drinking. So I would just really leave everything to him. Now I'm a little ornery. No. After I came out of that fog, the first time actually when I said to Roger, no, I don't want to do that. He did a double take. Huh? But he was real proud of me. He really liked it, and to this day, he just loves it. The more and more independent I get, the more he loves it.
So had you ever wanted to be independent before that?
I was independent, actually, monetarily, since the first time I sang with a band.
I mean more emotionally.
I don't know. I'm an only child. My father had the last word, and I was used to that. And Roger was and is very much a father figure, and he protects me, and I enjoy that. But I know that I can do all these things alone. I just don't choose to. I can open up my own door. I just don't like to.
Why don't you like to? Why would you want a man to open a door for you?
Because I just think it's civilized.
To defer to a man when you need to walk through a door?
Oh, are you trying to get to me?
I'm just curious.
You trying to get to me?
I'm trying to understand the impulse.
That's the way I was brought up, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I know we're from different generations. And, you know, I'm not 95 now, and... but I enjoy all that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Ah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Anne Margaret has written a new autobiography.
Well, child of 15, wired with braces from ear to ear. You doubt that you will ever be appealing. Then, hallelujah, you are 16 and the braces disappear, and your skin is smooth and clear, and you have that happy grown-up female feeling. How lovely to be a woman, the wait was well worthwhile. How lovely to wear mascara and smile a woman's smile. How lovely to have a figure that's round instead of flat. Whenever you hear boys whistle, you're what they're whistling at. It's wonderful to feel the way a woman feels.
Anne Margaret from the soundtrack of Bye Bye Birdie. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. NPR's Andy Bowers reports tonight from Sarajevo on confusion there about the authority of NATO and the United Nations. The UN-sponsored ceasefire is indeed holding in Sarajevo. I will talk with the UNHCR official about the continuing siege of Mostar in Bosnia, the standoff between Croat and Muslim forces. Lots of shelling there in recent days. Big trouble with electrical power in Mississippi. The power lines are down because of the ice storm last week. And Susan Stamberg has some thoughts on love and Valentine's Day, interviewing some couples who've been married for a long time. They're answering the question, how we stayed married.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Mavericks aren't your usual country music band. They're based in Miami, Florida, and their lead singer and chief songwriter, Raul Malo, is a first-generation Cuban-American. The Mavericks have just released their second collection called What a Cryin' Shame, and it sounds to rock critic Ken Tucker like their breakthrough album.
There goes my heart.
The first thing you're likely to notice about Raul Malo is the beautiful ache in his voice. When he sings, "There Goes My Heart Breaking in Two," Malo breaks the word two itself in half. His throaty tenor voice cracks in a quick sob that conveys all the yearning and regret that that lyric will hold. Instantly, in the first couplet of the album's first song, Malo has established the Mavericks' mastery of melancholy country ballads, and What a Crying Shame only gets better from there. At a time when the burgeoning country music industry is overrun with grinning, good-looking guys and gals eager to please, the Mavericks aren't afraid to pull long faces and brood at length on the loss of love.
Wasn't I good to you? Didn't I show it? And if I ever hurt you, I did it.
What a Crying Shame is a sort of concept album, a fearless set of songs about broken hearts and agonizing breakups. There's not a trace of macho swagger here. Indeed, the Mavericks seem almost masochistically resigned to the notion that, in any given relationship, it's the woman who holds the upper hand. Many of the collection's songs are addressed to a lover who has spurned the singer. On an emotionally complex yet simple song called Pretend, Malo even makes a plea for his beloved to act in public as if she still loves him, even if she no longer really does. Listening to this album makes you realize just how meaninglessly chipper so much popular country music is these days. The Mavericks' approach harks back to the sadder but wiser honky-tonk music of the 50s and 60s, when country crooners like Webb Pierce, Carl Smith, and Lefty Frizzell gave their fans a comforting thrill by suggesting that there's always someone out there whose life is in worse shape than yours. What a Crying Shame is a fine paradox, an exhilarating downer.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, and Audrey Voblaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our program was directed today by Naomi Person. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.